Hello and welcome to the latest brewing podcast. Today we're looking at the UK stock market, but going to move away from those larger listed businesses and focus on the FTSE 250 and a handful of AIM stocks that are of significant size. Now, these names are more sensitive to domestic economic performance and is why our guest speaker, Richard Watts of Merian, believes there exists an opportunity. And here is one such comment on Purple Bricks, which has had a particularly tricky week.
Because if we do get a more favourable Brexit outcome than you know, these fears of a no deal that have been priced into the market, Purple Bricks UK business will be a significant beneficiary of that.
Okay, for more comment on this name, as well as Fevertree, Boohoo and UK house builders and other names, please keep listening. But first, here are our disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation, which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewin Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest Brewin podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Head of Fund Research, and today we're going to be talking about UK mid-caps with the lead fund manager on the Merian Mid-Cap Fund, Richard Watts. Richard, a good friend to the podcast, and we're delighted to have you in. It's always a fascinating conversation because there is such interesting companies within your sector and, of course, within your fund. Now, I think the thread for the conversation is we want to talk, first of all, about the journey more recently. You know, the fourth quarter, clearly very painful, and a sharp recovery so far this year. Perhaps some explanation behind that. Then we can get into some companies, as I said, some really interesting businesses, whether it's sort of brands, Fevertree, fast fashion. There are some issues in relation to Purple Bricks that we'd like to get onto. And of course, you can't have any conversation without Brexit. And if we have time, we'll talk about some unlisted names that you're holding. So with all that in mind, let's go back to square one. The fourth quarter seemed a bit of an indiscriminate sell-off, but growth seemed to bear the brunt of it. What was your assessment how did you manage the portfolio and what have we seen so far this year?
Yeah, good morning, Ben. Look, I think you're right. I mean, you know, the fourth quarter was pretty indiscriminate from our perspective. I described it as a pretty toxic combination for UK mid and small caps. And that combination was, you know, the fear in the stock market generally of the Federal Reserve making a policy mistake. You know, the aggressive language around interest rate rises at the start of the quarter, going back to October the 3rd, you know, that caused a sell-off in growth and highly rated names, which obviously are well represented in our part of the market as well. And that was combined as we went through the quarter with elevated fears about Brexit, as, you know, the whole sort of Brexit process seemed to move on to another level, you know, with Theresa May coming back from Brussels with the withdrawal agreement. That didn't meet favour in Parliament and a vote of no confidence in Theresa May. So, you know, that just meant that highly rated growth names, UK domestic cyclicals, all of these areas.
It was a perfect storm.
Perfect storm for us. So it was very, very difficult.
So this year, I guess, has been a bit of a relief, rally, a snapback from oversold territory. But I guess, by and large, see the conditions still being favourable for these types of assets?
Yeah, look, we came into this year, you know, feeling quite a bit more constructive, and there were probably three reasons why. I think, firstly, given the underperformance of the fund that you saw in the fourth quarter of last year, you know, it did mean that we started this year where a number of our larger holdings looked significantly better value, you know, in terms of valuation multiples than they did. You know, at the end of the third quarter of 2018. So our starting point in terms of valuation of the fund was a lot more attractive.
Just to be clear on that, and there wasn't huge earnings downgrades, it was just a market derating of these businesses.
I would characterise Q4 as one about multiple compression for our fund. And a really good example that I've highlighted recently would be Boohoo.com. Boohoo started 2018 on a 12-month forward multiple of about 60 times earnings, which obviously, look, we accept it's a very high multiple, but reflects, you know, strong expected rates of earnings growth. But we finished 2018 on a multiple closer to 30 times. So the multiple almost halved, and most of that underperformance came through in Q4. So your starting point, you know, was one that, you know, looked an awful lot better in terms of valuation multiple than it even did at the end of Q3. And you could argue that for the likes of Fevertree, you know, Blue Prism, Burford Capital, lots of other stocks, particularly the AIM names, that were treated pretty adversely in Q4. You know, we started this year looking a lot better value. So that was the first factor. The second factor was, you know, the Federal Reserve. I mean, essentially, has made a U-turn, you know, and that's been confirmed with, you know, more recent statements. But it all goes back to January the 4th, where the Fed used the words patient and flexible, and patient in terms of, you know, being patient about you know, future interest rate rises, i.e., on hold, and flexible, essentially telling you that monetary policy wouldn't just consider interest rates, but also using the balance sheet. And I think, you know, it's subsequently been confirmed that, you know, the balance sheet unwind will probably come, you know, will probably go on hold at the end of this year. And the expectation of the market for many people is actually the next move in rates in the US is going to be down in 2020 and not up. So that's a significant change. I think, you know, using your money supply, your M2 money supply in the US as a proxy really for liquidity conditions in the US, this was the real fear in Q4, is that M2 money supply basically ground to a halt at the start of the quarter, having been grown at 5 to 6 percentage points year on year, 18 months or so ago.
This is a good guy for basically bank lending.
So this is basically bank lending and credit lending in the US and you know, government bond issuance and the amount of government bond sort of debt in circulation in the economy. And so this is basically reflecting sort of monetary policy. So obviously bank credit, you know, if interest rates rise, you know, people, you know, buy less houses, they buy less cars. And then obviously with the Federal Reserve balance sheet unwind as well, just obviously playing on the government bond side of the equation. So essentially using that as a proxy, you know, M2 money supply has bounced back strongly year to date. And is it any surprise, therefore, that the stock market's bounced back strongly? So, you know, all of these things are interconnected. But the simple fact is that the market was fearing a Fed mistake in Q4. And is less fearful of a Fed mistake now because the Fed has done a U-turn. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't challenges in the economy, but I think it's a lot better than where we were in Q4, I think. And then the final factor for us, of course, is Brexit. And I kind of feel as if the last 3 years, everything always, you know, for us has come back to Brexit. But I think if you look at, you know, currency markets and sterling in particular, you know, as a barometer for people's, you know, fears around Brexit, you know, significant sterling strength year to date, I think is telling you that the stock market is starting to price out the risk of a no deal Brexit and a soft Brexit or a cancellation of the whole Brexit process. I think would be very, very friendly for the UK mid-cap market, which is why, of course, the UK mid-caps have bounced back very strongly versus the FTSE 100 year to date. So a lot more constructive really coming into this year, Ben, I think is the short answer.
Okay, well, we appreciate that backdrop and do agree that the sort of conditions are more favourable. I guess, like you said, Brexit seems to come up in every conversation. We'll try to move on, but I guess it's hard to move away from Brexit when you're looking at more UK domestic cyclicals. And I know the house builders have enjoyed a swift recovery after a tricky 2018. I guess, I don't know if you talk about them in the round or if there's a couple in particular you'd like to pick out.
Yeah, and I think, look, it's pretty topical at the moment because obviously they've bounced back very strongly year to date in terms of share price performance, but there has been news flow over the last week or so. The latest being Taylor Wimpey this morning. And you look at Taylor Wimpey, I mean, all of that...
I guess the news flow is that, I guess, the government is concerned that the lending is sort of basically giving too much... allowing these house builders to make too much money.
I think it's well understood within the market that, you know, people believe there will be some successor scheme to the Help to Buy, and I think in that particular regard, I mean, most of the focus has been on Persimmon in terms of build quality and sort of value for money, and, you know, into that. So discussion is obviously the significant management remuneration bonuses that were received by the previous management team over the last year or so. But really, I think across the sector, I think the main focus has been on current trading. And current trading actually has been pretty robust, right? So you look at Taylor Wimpey this morning, the forward order book is up 11% year on year. And that's a very strong performance in the context of, people's Brexit fears. So the house builders, traded very, very well, right, over the last, well, I'll say the last year, but they've traded very well for a number of years. And yes, we accept that it's been helped by Help to Buy. It's not just about Help to Buy, but so look, these are businesses that offer very attractive dividend yields that are traded very robustly. And I think there's a very strong argument to make here that once consumers and businesses get clarity on what Brexit actually means, and I think if it's a soft Brexit, i.e. we basically avoid a no deal or a harder Brexit, if the outlook for the UK economy looks a pretty good one, which we think it does, better consumer confidence, better business confidence, this is going to be very, very good for the house builders, as it is for a lot of other UK domestic cyclicals. And there's a lot of value on offer here still. So look, that's a sector that the fund...
What sort of environment do you think house builders are pricing in then at the moment? Presumably you think it's a too pessimistic one.
Yeah, I think it is. Look, I mean, dividend yields across the sector, I mean, Persimmon is yielding 10%. Now, maybe you could argue that there's some fears on Help to Buy, Persimmon being excluded from the next scheme, beyond 2021. So maybe that's not helping Persimmon. But, Barrett's in the state yield is, 8 to 9% dividend yield. Taylor Wimpey, close to 10%. So, I look at these businesses and the question is, what is the right dividend yield for these companies? And look, I always argued years and years ago that before this whole Brexit thing really kicked off, and this my thesis never really got tested because of the Brexit backdrop. But, if you believe that you're in a good economic environment in the UK, which we think we will be, and you get, bill volume growth, you get modest, house price growth. And so therefore you get, pretty meaningful growth in dividends. Why can't these house builders yield, 6-7%? And, you go from, yields of 8 to 10 to 6 to 7. I mean, it doesn't sound a lot, but you're probably looking at maybe, 25, 30, 40% on share prices, plus your dividend. And so that could be pretty meaningful. So look, this is a sector that would be very interesting. It's the obvious way of playing UK domestic cyclicals, in our view. And for that reason, the fund is meaningfully overweight this area now.
Okay, well, we'll stay on the theme of property, and perhaps certainly in the introduction, I should have said, how the quality of this fund, the long-term outperformance that it's delivered, and notwithstanding that, you are in high growth names. Every now and then, the sector can have a wobble, and of course, some higher rated names can exhibit a bit more volatility. We had one such name this week in the form of Purple Bricks, or last week, sorry. It's had a tough time. And also had a really tough week last week. I don't know if you want to sort of tell us about your investment thesis or the opportunity that's on offer here. Although I guess I'm sure you can see there are risks to every names in the portfolio.
Yeah, and I think we've got to start off with Purple Bricks. That there was probably more risk in that name than there are others in the portfolio. And for that reason, our starting position was smaller. This was a 1.5% unit, and we're looking away from it. Last Thursday was disappointing, but Purple Bricks needs to be viewed, I think, in this way. You have a UK business, and then you have fledgling businesses that they are trying to establish in other countries around the world. It was very obvious that the UK business was likely to modestly disappoint, which it did, because we can track this every day. I mean, you just go on Zoopla, and you can track the number of houses that they are listing. So we fully expected the UK business to be soft. So that didn't surprise us. This is a Brexit play, bluntly. Outside of the UK, it was disappointing that the US and Australia are not performing as they'd hoped. But fundamentally, when you look at the share price, the UK business more than accounts the market cap of this company. And it's interesting that the shares fell at one point intraday 35%. They ended the day down 25%, and then in the subsequent days, they've added another 10 to 15% onto the share price. So compared to where we were on the closing price on the Wednesday before the profit downgrades, the shares are down 13-14%, okay. which is not a disaster. But we were aware of this, and the trouble obviously that we get, of course, is that we're factoring all of this stuff into our investment thesis. why do I own it? Because if we do get a more favourable Brexit outcome than you know, these fears of a no deal that have been priced into the market, Purple Brick's UK business will be a significant beneficiary of that. And if that happens, then there is value in this share. So, you know,
presumably the US space is a pretty competitive one and hard to crack, and we hear lots of negative news flow and data on Australian housing. I mean, I guess all of that sort of comes for free, I guess is what you're saying,
But
now, I mean, they're still difficult stories.
It's very interesting here, right, because the business has got £70 million on the balance sheet, and we think this UK business, over the next 12 months, could make £20 to £25 million of profit. Now, these online retail companies, they trade at 20 times plus on the EBITDA. So you end up with a UK business that itself could be worth £400 to £500 million with £70 million of cash on the balance sheet. And at one point intraday, on Thursday, the entire market cap got down to the low 300s. So there's obvious value here. And, you know, the answer is, do they just shut the US and do they shut Australia? Now, you know, the company wouldn't like to do that. But I would sort of say that when you look at the shareholder register, 75% of the equity of that company is held by five hands. You know, it's ourselves, it's Woodford, it's Axel Springer, and it's the management team and some others. And, you know, that's a very, very tightly held register. Now, Axel Springer bought into that business at a share price of about 360p a year or so ago. You know, presumably they liked the international expansion story. But in my view, look, you know, if it's not going to work, then you just close it down and you stop doing it and you retreat to becoming a very profitable UK, fast-growing UK profitable business that has a lot of value in it. So
and operationally, are they performing well? I mean, I know this is perhaps dinner party stuff, but yeah. I mean, I don't know enough of my friends or peers
I think they are. They are certainly performing well enough. I mean, could they do better? Yeah, of course they could, right? But I think they are doing well enough because when you look at their market share in the UK, their market share in the UK is consistently increasing. So, you know, we mustn't forget that the UK housing market has been really very soft, the secondary housing market has been very soft for the last 6 months. And so, you know, Purple Bricks, it can't buck that trend, but it's still grown its own volume. So it's telling you that it's taking market share a fair old clip. Within the online hybrids or the online agents, Purple Bricks has maintained its share, you know, consistently at, you know, the 70 to 75% level. So it tells me that, you know, this business model is working in the UK. It just isn't really establishing itself outside of the UK yet. And I think it comes back to us, you know, the answer might be at some point they just have to shut it down and just say, look, we've had a go, it's not worked, but let's just focus on the UK, and that could be a very, very valuable business.
Okay, well, we'll move on from there. I mean, some names I always find interesting to talk about would be the brands, and Fevertree, I know, is a share you support and had fantastic time out of over the duration of the holding. But again, you know, fourth quarter had a tougher time, but bouncing nicely now. You know, you talked about it last time on the podcast. I guess we'd be interested to know how its pursuit of cracking America is going. I don't know if much has changed.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think that's probably the thing in Q4, really. I mean, we always knew that the UK business rate of growth would slow. I mean, you know, you cannot keep on growing a business at 100% year on year, because obviously in pound notes terms, you know, that's every year is getting bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of the incremental delta that you have to add on. And you can track the AC Nielsen data on a weekly basis. So, you know, the slowdown in UK growth is not a surprise. Our continued desire to hold the stock was really predicated, as you just pointed out, on the US, but not just the US, but, you know, growth in Europe and the rest of the world as well. You know, just to put this into perspective, about 50% of total sales come from the UK and 50% are overseas. So, you know, if they crack these overseas markets, so this is potentially very, very material. I think specifically looking at the US, they signed a new distribution agreement in the middle of last year, and they moved from a small distributor to the number one distributor in the US, number one in 29 states in America. And I think, in fairness, and I think we share this expectation, I think there's an expectation that sales in the US would ramp up more quickly on the back of that new distribution agreement than they actually did through the second half. And I think now that we understand the reasons why, I mean, you're basically transitioning from one agreement to another one, so stocks are being unwound before the new agreements really got going. But, you know, in our view, I think 2019 is going to look pretty exciting for the US. So this is a big opportunity. And, And again, I think that's part of the reason why the share price has bounced back quite nicely. Obviously, the overall market has picked up pretty meaningfully so far this year. And I think there's an understanding here that it's not always, you know, companies don't always sort of deliver things in a straight line, and it does take time. But Fevertree, you know, the share price at one point has recovered back to £29. It got down to £22 in Q4. So we used the opportunity to buy more stock on that significant share price weakness, but it just felt overdone, really.
Okay, well, it's a stock we could keep talking about. We want to get a few more names in before we run out of time. I guess the fast fashion names, again, have been a consistent part of this portfolio. Great growth prospects. Coming under a bit of scrutiny of late based on what we call sort of ESG factors in our line of work. You know, I guess one of the stories is in relation to the amount of water it takes to produce items, and also there is concerns about the treatment of staff. You know, I guess, you know, you're in the business of making profits for shareholder unit holders, but you know, you will have one eye, you'll certainly have a close eye on the way staff are treated and their contribution to environmental sustainability.
Yeah, and I think that's I think the first thing to say is that we take ESG very seriously at Merian, and we engage with, you know, with our portfolio holdings very actively on ESG matters. In specific regard to Boohoo, you know, they do take ESG seriously, and you know, they are members of various organisations in relation to sustainability and your labour conditions and labour relations. You know, do they always get things absolutely perfectly? I think, you know, the answer is no, right? And I think, you know, we have to understand where this company's come from. You know, it's grown rapidly over the last 6 to 7 years, and you know, managing that rate of growth is not, you know, it's not an easy challenge. And so sometimes, you know, would you like them to be leading the industry on certain matters? You know, the answer is yes. Do they always lead the industry? Well, unfortunately not. But that doesn't mean that they don't take ESG seriously. They do. And so we've engaged pretty extensively with Boohoo on this. You know, like, I find it very difficult, really, because, look, we are invested in a company and, you know, we understand, you know, issues around, you know, how much water it takes to, you know, to manufacture clothes, you know, and other issues. But, you know, these are not issues that are specific or unique to Boohoo. You know, these are industry-wide issues. And look, you know, from that perspective, as long as Boohoo are engaging with the industry and trying to find solutions, then we'll just keep on pushing.
And names such as ASOS and Boohoo still stand up as a investment opportunity given the sort of consumer dynamics?
Yeah, and again, I think we should remember, of course, is that when you're, you know, when you're an industry leader and you're a very high profile company, then, you know, you come under more scrutiny than probably most other players in the sector. And, you know, that kind of goes with the territory. And I think, you know, from my perspective, we're trying to sort of reflect that here, that, you know, is this a Boohoo issue, you know, specifically? And, as, you know, for me, it's no. You know, this is an industry issue. But Boohoo and, you know, ASOS, you know, they're much higher profile companies. So, you know, they feature in the press a lot more than many other, you know, companies in the industry. So for me, in terms of the investment thesis, of course, you know, we've got to make sure that the company are doing all the right things, that the company are actually managing the supply chain properly, and the suppliers are, you know, running their own businesses, you know, according to ESG principles and doing the right thing for staff and labour conditions. And so, you know, this is why we engage the company. But, you know, taking the view that they are doing all of those right things, you know, this is an investment decision. This comes down to the valuation of the company, you know, the earnings growth on offer and the global growth opportunity in front of it. So, you know, we don't want the company to fall down on ESG matters, but assume they get the ESG right, which we think they are getting it right, then, you know, the investment thesis is around valuation and earnings growth and the opportunity ahead of them.
I mean, let's take Boohoo, for example. I mean, is it solely dependent? I mean, I don't know enough about its range, but seemingly heavily dependent on Pretty Little Things. And is that... you know, what is the maturity of that of those growth rates?
Yeah, and so again, I mean, it's very akin to you know, Fevertree, really. At some point, the rate of growth has to slow, right? Because the business is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger. When you look at PLT, you know, it's almost the size of the Boohoo brand. It's not quite there yet, but you know, we think it probably gets there and might even overtake it in the next 12 months. So it's been a phenomenal success for the company. And And again, I think, you know, there's been some debate in the market, you know, the slower rates of BOO and much faster rates of growth of PLT. And I think people have to understand, you know, there is a cannibalization effect going on here. You know, PLT has cannibalized Boohoo, but Boohoo has grown, PLT has grown exceptionally well. The rest of the industry is struggling. And why? Because the whole Boohoo group is eating their lunch. And again, you know, coming back to matters of ESG, and we saw this with Purple Bricks. You know, the industry fights back aggressively, and if you can't fight back on, you know, trading and economic, you know, fundamentals, because it's very difficult to compete with a business like Boohoo because their price points are so much lower, because their business is just set up for fast fashion. How else do they compete? You know, and they compete by, you know, trying to disparage the company, or, you know, kind of putting stories out into the press. And again, you know, I think people need to understand that, you know, this is a fact of life, right? So, you know, so Boohoo are competing against competitors more than just, you know, more than just one way.
Yeah. Okay. And then to round out on businesses you own, I know you actually, to a degree, will deviate from listed companies. And, well, you'll have a sprinkling of unlisted names in the portfolio. They certainly won't dominate. It'll be a very small relative position, but there is some interesting things, names in there, and, you know, offers another means to differentiate your fund relative to others. But I don't know if there's sort of a couple of names or a single name you want to mention in the time we have left.
Yeah, and look, I think we've got some interesting stocks here. I mean, your names like TransferWise and Starling Bank, you know, they feature pretty heavily in the press in recent weeks. So look, I think in this particular basket of unlisted stocks, it's circa 5% of the portfolio, which we think is pretty modest. But, you know, these are very exciting companies that we think over time it will add a lot of value to clients in the fund and provide, you know, a forward pipeline of IPO prospects and opportunities for us. So I look at the overall shape of the portfolio. We do have exposure to some of the more highly rated growth names, you know, listed and unlisted. But these are very, very disruptive companies that we think will grow much faster than market averages for year after year after year. And we think the valuation multiples that we're paying, yes, they are higher, but, you know, they are cheap in comparison to the rates of earnings growth that we expect them to deliver. And you can see that on the PEG, you know, the portfolio, so the price earnings multiple, you know, divided by growth of the fund is sub one in 2020. And it's sub one because, look, you know, the valuation multiples of these fast growing stocks, I think, personally are cheap. And then obviously we do have exposure to, you know, house builders and the domestic cyclicals like the Challenger Banks that trade on very cheap valuation multiples. So I think for us, you know, in an environment of more clarity around Brexit, you know, a portfolio trading on a peg of sub one in 2020 looks very, very good value indeed.
Okay, I guess the final couple of questions. Who's going to win the Six Nations?
Well, I think the obvious answer is Wales, isn't it?
And, who's going to win the World Cup?
I'm not sure who's going to be Wales, actually, but... I'll put my money on New Zealand, but I'd like to think some of the home nations are going to be there or thereabouts.
Well, a really enjoyable conversation, interview, but a less than satisfying conclusion there, I think. I think England is still within the chance, certainly on Six Nations. But Richard, thanks very much for all your insight there. As I said, we really did enjoy your contribution and congratulate you on behalf of clients. You know, thank you for the long-term returns that you've delivered on their behalf. To our clients, to our listeners, let us know what you think on Twitter, referencing hashtag Bruin Podcast, or leave a review on iTunes or SoundCloud, or whatever platform you listen to us through. But until next time, many thanks for listening.